WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. July 4th is the 50th anniversary of the Philippines' independence from the U.S. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Alan Burlow, who covered the Philippines for NPR. His new book, Dead Season, investigates a murder mystery in the Philippines and examines the larger question of why democracy has been so difficult to establish there. Also today, the cheap thrills of island biogeography. We talk with science writer David Quammen about the freakish creatures that evolve on islands, like the Komodo dragon and giant spiders. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Walking Wounded, the new release by the British duo Everything But the Girl. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. A decision handed down by the Supreme Court today could end up costing taxpayers billions of dollars. The justices ruled that the government is liable for an accounting rule change that pushed a number of savings and loan institutions into the red. The rule had encouraged healthy thrifts to take over SNLs that were on the brink of bankruptcy. The healthy institutions were allowed to count the losses of the failing ones as so-called goodwill assets. But in 1989, the government ended that practice. The court was considering the case of three SNLs that sued the government for breach of contract, but there are about 100 similar cases, and the Clinton administration has estimated that the total cost to the Treasury could be up to $10 billion. Security at the U.S. housing complex in Dahran has been tightened. After twice refusing to do so, the Saudis have allowed the U.S. to broaden the security zone around the facility. NPR's Eric Weiner explains.
U.S. officials have constructed a new security barrier, new concrete barrier. Instead of being just 80 feet away from the nearest building, this one is being erected 400 feet away. Secretary of Defense Perry, who was here over the weekend, says this will make the base considerably less vulnerable to the kind of bomb blast that occurred last Tuesday.
A senior Air Force official says a Saudi woman saw a suspicious-looking truck outside the complex about 2 weeks before the blast that killed 19 Americans. She challenged the driver, and he drove off. The official says the incident was reported to police. The FBI is checking out the lead. Russian President Boris Yeltsin, who's been out of sight for 4 days, finally made an appearance today on Russian television. NPR's Anne Garrels reports from Moscow.
President Boris Yeltsin has been out of sight since last Wednesday. He canceled campaign trips and several scheduled meetings. His aides explained away his absence, saying he had lost his voice, but not one of his aides reported actually meeting with him. His campaign rival, Gennady Zyuganov, fueled pre-election jitters, demanding a medical commission. The president's absence, he said, is very strange. With just 2 days to go before the presidential runoff, Yeltsin appeared briefly on Russian television this afternoon in a taped clip, urging voters to go to the polls. It's unclear when this was recorded. Later, he was shown sitting beside his prime minister, Viktor Chernomyrdin. The Russian president looked wooden and stiff. These glimpses of Yeltsin have not resolved questions about his health. I'm Ann Garrels in Moscow.
Traces of Molotov cocktails and gasoline have been found in the rubble of a black church in Maysville, North Carolina, that went up in flames yesterday. The blaze was one of three suspicious church fires on Sunday. Another, which occurred at a Kansas Catholic church attended mostly by whites, has also been ruled an arson fire. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up nearly 25 points in active trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index is up about 8 points. This is NPR News. The Alumni Board of the Virginia Military Institute is reportedly proposing that the school raise the necessary funds to become a private institution so it can remain all male. The Supreme Court last week ruled that the state-supported school must admit women as cadets or give up its government funding. The only other state-supported military college in the country, the Citadel, has announced that it will begin accepting women this fall. German officials say the Irish Republican Army is responsible for a bombing last week on a British military base in Germany. NPR's Deidre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
A spokesman for the Federal Prosecutor's Office in Karlsruhe says the target and the method used for the bombing indicate an IRA attack. No one was hurt, but the attack in Osnabrück in northern Germany caused considerable property damage. On Sunday, an anonymous caller phoned an Irish television station and claimed IRA responsibility for the bombing. German officials have asked for information on a Ford vehicle with British license plates spotted outside the base. A year ago, a German court sentenced four IRA members to long jail sentences for an earlier attack on the British base in Osnabrück. The most recent incident was the first IRA bombing on German soil since 1990. I'm Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
Construction spending fell nearly a full percent in May. The Commerce Department says that decline was the first drop in 3 months. First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton is in Romania on the start of an 11-day goodwill tour of Eastern Europe. Several thousand people gathered to greet her in a public square in Bucharest, where just a few years ago, dozens were killed during the violent overthrow of dictator Nicolae Ceausescu. Mrs. Clinton says the U.S. supports Romania's fledgling democracy. After her speech, she visited a hospital for children infected with the AIDS virus. Several of them sang songs to her, and one girl brought tears to the First Lady's eyes when she sang a lullaby to a doll that she clutched to her chest. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As we prepare to celebrate the anniversary of our independence from England, consider this. Thursday, July 4th, is the 50th anniversary of the Philippines' independence from the United States. The Philippines was the only major seas colony of the U.S. My guest, Alan Berlow, was NPR's correspondent in Manila from 1988 to 92. He's written a new book called Dead Season, a story of murder and revenge on the Philippine island of Negros. Berlow investigates the massacre of a family and the death of a young soldier. These stories illustrate the larger story of why it's so difficult to create democracy at the end of the 20th century. The cases Berlow investigated occurred 2 years after the so-called People Power Revolution that brought down the Marcos dictatorship in 1986, yet no justice was delivered. I asked Berlow what initially interested him in the murder mystery that he investigated.
I was initially sent to the island of Negros to investigate the murder of a political activist who had been shot dead in front of his wife and small child by one of the death squads on this island that was allegedly run by the wealthy sugarcane planters. And in the course of investigating that murder, I met a young man who told me an incredible story. He said that his family had been massacred by the military, that they'd come to his house in the middle of the night, surrounded it, a bunch of men in masks, shot up the place with rifles and rocket-propelled grenades. And he himself had been shot and wounded and left for dead. And when he awoke, his mother came stumbling into the room with blood pouring out of her mouth. She couldn't speak to him. And she attempted to talk, but couldn't. And she signaled to him that she wanted to write something. And he couldn't find anything to write with. So she dipped her finger into her mouth and used the blood to write this cryptic message, Maroi. I was intrigued by Maroi and wanted to find out who or what he was and to look into that story. And as I began looking into that murder, people told me all sorts of other stories about other people in this tiny, tiny little barrio, a place called Mambagaton, which translated means the place of the ghosts. The massacre of this family was connected to the murder of the wealthiest landlord in this little town. People told me that the father of this family that was massacred had himself murdered one of his neighbors, he was an informant for the Communist Party, and on and on and on. And I wanted to unravel these stories because they seemed to say something about how people in a small community where there were vigilantes, religious cultists, private landlord armies, how they tried to make sense of a world in which there was no operative justice system, nobody to make sense out of all of this violence for them.
Did you ever find the solution to Maroi, the word that the mother who was dying wrote in her own blood?
Well, Maroi was actually the best friend of Moret de los Santos, the head of this family, and was an alleged military informant. And what's interesting about the Maroi story is that Priscilla de los Santos, the woman who wrote Maroi in her own blood, is in effect fingering this man, saying, he did it. I don't think Maroi had much of anything to do with the massacre of the de los Santos family. So she fingers him, and her husband is accused he's allegedly responsible for the murder of the wealthiest landlord in this town, a guy by the name of Serafin Gadislau, commonly known as the Batman. I don't think he had anything to do with the murder of Serafin Gadislau, but the military claims it that this massacre was a reprisal for the murder of Gadislau. And after that, about 2 weeks after the massacre, there was one of the soldiers who was involved in the massacre ends up dead. And I believe that this guy, whose name was Jerry de los Santos, committed suicide because he felt he was responsible for this massacre, when in fact, I don't think he was. So you have all of these people dying for nothing. They're accused of things that they didn't do. They take responsibility for things that they're not responsible for, and they don't take responsibility for things that they are responsible for.
Do you feel like you ever found out who did it?
I know who did who was responsible for the massacre because I spent about 2 years trying to track down all of the soldiers who were involved. One of the ideas behind this project was to attempt to interview everybody who was in any way involved with the massacre, sort of like a Rashomon story, and see, you know, what the different versions of it added up to. So I know who was responsible for the massacre. I know there is a Captain Melvin Gutierrez, who has since been promoted, was in charge of the massacre. And I know that none of them were ever brought to justice and won't be.
Do you think that the story that you tell in your new book, The Dead Season, is basically telling a larger story of how difficult it is to achieve democracy in the Philippines?
Yeah, I do. I think that when you look at Negros, you can see that it has a democracy in name. There are elected officials, although all of them are wealthy. There is rampant vote buying throughout the country. The difficulties of creating democracy at the end of the 20th century in the Philippines are very similar to those in many countries around the world. You have widespread environmental degradation on Negros. All of the mountains are barren. All of the trees have been logged. That, in turn, caused serious soil erosion, destruction of the coral reefs around the island. Without forests, people went into the mangrove swamps and used that wood for fuel. So you have very, very limited resources and all of it being held by a small number of people. And it's very difficult for people to not only to get by, but to create any sort of wealth. And I think that it's fine to have elections, even though the elections are frequently very corrupt in the Philippines. It's another thing to get democratic institutions to work. The main problem on Negros, and I think throughout the Philippines, one of the main problems is that the justice system simply doesn't work. And without any sort of justice, it's hard for a democracy to function.
It also seems from the way you describe it that each group lives in the fear of other groups. The government fears the military. The military is in opposition to the church. The church fears the military. Then you've got the landowners with their own little death squads.
Yeah, there is rampant fear throughout the country. And what I tried to do in this book was to show how that fear is reflected at the local level, where you have the mayor of the town who is so afraid of the military that she's unwilling to even condemn this massacre. I trace that from her to the provincial government, governor, who was also silent on this massacre, and take the case through the military and right up to the office of President Aquino, who also refused to act on this case. Everybody was afraid. Aquino was afraid that she was going to be overthrown. There were repeated coup attempts against her. In one of the earliest of these, in August 1987, her son, namesake of her martyred husband, Benigno Aquino III, the son was shot. Aquino was so afraid that she simply refused to do anything in the area of human rights, anything that would challenge the military.
Ellen, why are you so caught up in the story of the Philippines?
Well, I got caught up in this particular story because of the mysteries involved in it, and also just because it was a fascinating story, this particular massacre and the implications of it. I was in the Philippines at the time of the People Power Revolution, which was 10 years ago, February. It was a very heady time there. People came away with a feeling that, my God, you know, the people at large could actually accomplish great things, that simple people without guns could stand up and could take control. But what I found in living there for 5 years was that it's a lot easier to create revolutions than it is to create democracies. And the process of creating democracy in the Philippines is a fascinating process, one that has been going on for literally 100 years now.
Well, the lesson that you just mentioned, that it's easier to create revolutions than it is to create a democracy, is a lesson that's being learned all around the globe right now.
Yeah, no, I look at Eastern Europe, the former Soviet Union, and I see the Philippines in many respects. And the Philippines has a leg up on many of these places, in part because it was a colony of the United States. The colonial experience having established democratic institutions of sorts, modeled almost exactly on our own system, established a bureaucracy that, while highly inefficient, is set up to deal with the broader concerns of the society. In many of these other countries, they're really starting from square one. I mean, I've been in places like Burma where you ask people, what are you fighting for? And they'll say, we're fighting for democracy. And you ask them, can you define democracy? And they scratch their heads and they say, well, we know it's better than what we've got now.
The so-called People Power Revolution in the Philippines was a revolution without guns. But in retrospect, how much of a role did the military actually play, maybe behind the scenes?
The military had been preparing a coup against Marcos. A reform movement within the military had been planning a coup for at least 6 months. They were in effect caught. The coup was exposed, and as a result, they decided to revolt. Fidel Ramos, who is now the president of the Philippines, was one of two major coup leaders, the other being Senator Juan Ponce Enrile, who became Aquino's Secretary of Defense. Without these two men, Marcos would have remained in office probably until his death.
My guest is Alan Berlow. From 1988 to 92, he was NPR's correspondent based in Manila. His new book is called Dead Season. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Alan Berlow, author of the new book, Dead Season, a story of murder and revenge on the Philippine island of Negros. It's also the story of the Philippine struggle as an emerging democracy. July 4th is the anniversary, the 50th anniversary of the day that the Philippines got independence from the United States. When the United States seized the Philippines from the Spanish in 1898, it was with the intention of making it a showcase for democracy in Asia. How much did we really try to do that?
I think we did a great deal. In the first 20 years of the U.S. occupation, there was massive investment in infrastructure, roads, education, public health. The literacy rate in the Philippines rose from 20% to 50%. By 1920, it was the highest in Asia. I think that we went in with good intentions after a very, very vigorous debate in the Congress over whether the United States, a nation founded in an anti-imperialist struggle, should be having any sort of colony. We had a guilty conscience, and we decided to, we tried to do good in the Philippines. So there was an enormous amount that the United States did for the Philippines, but I think at the same time that throughout this history, and it's nearly a 100-year history at this point, the United States always stood with the landed elite, always stood with the oligarchs. And if you look at some of the writings from the time of the occupation, Americans were saying, you know, what needs to be done here is that the land has to be redistributed. The CIA made the same assessment in 1949, shortly after World War II. The same assessment was made by Aquino's husband in 1965. Everybody has known what needed to be done in the Philippines, but for one reason or another, the elite, the wealthy landed oligarchs were never challenged.
Do you think that the president of the Philippines, Fidel Ramos, is moving the country closer to democracy?
Yeah, I think that Ramos really cares about democracy. I covered his campaign in 1992, and the one quote from him that sticks in his mind was he said to me that, "I don't want my country to become a banana republic." A lot of people looked at the Philippines and still do as a banana republic, as the so-called sick child of Asia. But Ramos is the man most responsible for preserving President Aquino in power. He stood down the military. You can criticize the way he did it. I mean, the first coup attempt against Aquino, Ramos punished the military people involved by ordering them to do 50 push-ups. I mean, people thought that was ludicrous at the time. But Ramos did stand up for democracy. I think he really wants to make democracy work. He's not the most innovative guy you could imagine. They call him Steady Eddie. He's slow. He's cautious. I don't think he's, I don't think Ramos is the greatest leader that the country will ever see. But I think he does care about democracy. I think he's been very good for the Philippines.
There are nearby places in Southeast Asia that are basically now experiments in dictatorship and capitalism with thriving economies, places like Singapore, Thailand. Is the Philippines considered an example of what goes wrong or what goes right when a country tries to head toward democracy?
Well, I think someone like Senior Minister Lee Kuan Yew of Singapore would and has referred to the Philippines as a place as an example of exactly what's wrong. I mean, there's a conceit in Southeast Asia that democracy and free enterprise and development don't go hand in hand. The Philippines is somewhat unique in that regard, and Ramos has stated, you know, we did things a little backwards for Southeast Asia. We established our democratic institutions first, and now we're attempting to create spurred development. It's not the Asian model. It's not the Asian way of doing things, but you can't forget the tradition of American rule in the Philippines, and I don't think Filipinos would have it any other way.
I wonder, when you were covering the Philippines for National Public Radio and living there, what it was like for you as a middle-class, decently paid professional to be in a country where most people are either very poor or very rich. And actually, it's only a few people who are very rich. Most people are very poor. And, you know, you're there as a middle-class professional.
Yeah, it's a constant contradiction. I mean, from the house servants that you employ. I lived in a cute little compound that literally across the wall from where I lived was a squatter community. And unbelievable things happened in that squatter community. I remember one day there was a big funeral procession for a small boy who had committed suicide because his family didn't have money to buy him clothes to go to school, and the family didn't want to send him to school without new clothes. And, you know, it's a city that is a case study in metastasizing decay. It was built for about 2 million people. It now has something on the order of 11 or 12, about, it's got 2 million squatters. I mean, it is one of the ugliest cities that you can imagine. And it's a constant contradiction to live there, to have beggars tapping at your window and, you know, people with their hands out. You know, you're there to report about it.
My understanding is that most middle-class people and most middle-class Americans who live in the Philippines have servants. It's just something that's done. And it's considered good for the economy, too. It's the only way these people would end up making a living. How did it feel for you to have servants?
Well, I didn't have servants, plural. We had a maid. Having a maid is a little strange, but on the other hand, you need somebody to be in your house at all times when you're not there to prevent people from coming in and having it robbed. We were actually in the United States when the government decided to bulldoze the five houses in our compound, and we got this hysterical call from our maid telling us that the bulldozers had come and that we had until the end of the day to clear out our belongings, and there was no way we were going to get back to the Philippines. So she took care of that and and got our things into storage. But, you know, it's useful to have someone around every now and then.
I'm sure, you know, when you got back to the United States, you were talking about, you know, how there's beggars all over in the Philippines and people banging on your door all the time. Well, there's homeless people all around in the United States and people asking you for money every step of the way in most American cities now. Did you feel like a different relationship to the very poor in the Philippines than you do with the very poor in the United States?
No, I feel very much that it's the same situation. You know, this is my country. I was a visitor in the Philippines, but you come back from the third world, you come back from a country where there is this rampant crime and poverty, and you look at the situation in the United States and you say, you know, it's not that different. It's a matter of degree. The Philippines, in terms of its democracy, may be 100 years behind the United States. In terms of its development, is never going to catch up. But in very fundamental ways, the problems are the same.
Alan, this July 4th is the 50th anniversary of the Philippines' independence from the United States. How is July 4th celebrated in the Philippines?
It's not. The Philippines... In 1962, President Macapagal changed the date for their independence celebration to June 12th, commemorating the Declaration of Independence from Spain. And after that, there was a brief period during which the Filipinos celebrated something called Philippine-American Friendship Day. That, too, has gone by the boards. The date is not celebrated in large part because of nationalist resentment about the way in which independence was granted to the Philippines. There were these feelings that there were strings attached, that it was in many ways the Independence Day that wasn't, that we Filipinos were granted independence, but the United States continued to exert enormous political influence in the country and by design attempted to control the country economically. So it's a sore point among Filipinos who have thought about the 4th of July, who've thought about that anniversary, and for that reason it's not celebrated.
So no big fireworks in the Philippines on July 4th.
Well, there's actually going to be a reenactment of the July 4th that took place 50 years ago.
Oh.
Fireworks were never a big thing in the Philippines, I think, in part because so many people had guns to shoot off, and the rest didn't want to be blowing up the little money that they had. There were parades and that sort of thing, but fireworks never caught on.
Well, Alan Brillo, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Terry.
Alan Brillo's new book about the Philippines is called Dead Season. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, science writer David Quammen tells us about his encounter with the Komodo dragon. His new book, Song of the Dodo, is about the improbable creatures that evolve on islands. And Ken Tucker reviews the new release by the English duo Everything But the Girl. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. David Quammen has discovered the cheap thrills that island biogeography has to offer. He says many of the world's gaudiest life forms, both plant and animal, occur on islands. Java has a pygmy rhinoceros, Komodo a giant lizard. Until recently, St. Helena was home to a species of giant earwig, that dreaded and repulsive insect. Want to hear more? David Quammen has traveled around the world tracking down the improbable creatures that inhabit islands. His new book is about those creatures and about the evolutionary science that explains why islands are breeding grounds for extravagant and freakish species. His new book is called Song of the Dodo. Quammen is a two-time recipient of the National Magazine Award for his science essays in Outside Magazine. I ask Quammen why islands tend to breed giant and miniature-sized creatures.
Isolation, geographical isolation, is one of the driving forces of evolution. Islands provide complete or more complete instances of geographical isolation. Their ecosystems tend to be simpler, containing fewer species, fewer competitors, fewer predators than a mainland ecosystem. And for those reasons, evolution tends to be more drastic, more abrupt, more experimental, and more speedy on islands. So that you get these patterns of evolution on islands, patterns toward gigantism, patterns toward dwarfism, patterns toward flightlessness, and patterns toward evolutionary experiments that the more crowded, more competitive bustle of mainland ecosystems will not support and would not forgive.
Now, when you're talking about islands, obviously you're talking about land that's surrounded by water. But there are conditions similar to islands that are being created within large bodies of land.
Exactly. And that's what makes this field, island biogeography, a field of global scope. It applies not just to the littoral islands surrounded by ocean, but to any patches of landscape surrounded by other forms of landscape that are inhospitable. For instance, a patch of forest surrounded by grassland is an island as far as forest-dwelling species are concerned. A patch of wetland surrounded by airport runways is an island if you happen to be a frog. And likewise, human-caused isolation of patches of landscape, like with the case of the wetland surrounded by airport runways.
So are we starting to breed giant size or dwarfed species because of all these new islands that we're creating on the land because of this new fragmentation of land?
We really aren't, and that's a very good question because it gets to something important. There are two things that are extraordinary or that are exceptional, notable about island ecosystems. They tend to be especially conducive to the evolution of species, and they tend to be especially conducive to the extinction of species. And what's happening now that we are fragmenting the mainland's landscapes into islands is that we're getting the second of those two phenomena, but not the first. Why are we getting the second? Because evolution can happen only slowly over long stretches of time, but extinction can happen quickly. So the extinction side of the phenomenon is preempting the possibility of evolution on these human-caused fragments of habitat.
Oh, so species are dying out before they have the chance to evolve.
Exactly, yeah. Most of the species that have gone extinct within the last 400 years have been island species. But now we're starting to see the extinction of populations of animals and plants on mainland fragments of landscape that function as ecological islands.
Well, you went to the island of Komodo in part to see the Komodo dragon. First, you should tell us where Komodo is.
Komodo is an island in central Indonesia, a couple of island stops east of Bali.
Okay, now, the Komodo dragon, you should, I should say, first of all, that people who saw the movie The Freshman will know what the Komodo dragon
right,
looks like.
Right, although, you know, that was a stand-in, I gather.
Was it really?
That was a large relative of the Komodo. They're lizards that belong to the family Varanidae, otherwise known as monitor lizards. And there are a couple of different species that grow large, though not as large as the Komodo. And I think that was one of the Australian monitor lizards standing in as a Komodo with Matthew Broderick and Brando, wasn't it?
Yes. Well, a fraud. So tell us what the real Komodo dragon looks like.
The real Komodo dragon grows to about 10 feet long, weighs somewhere between 200 and 400 or 500 pounds, depending on whether it's just glutted itself on a meal. It's got sort of a friendly-looking hound dog old shoe face until it opens its mouth, and then you see that it's got this incredible set of shark-like teeth that are really made for ripping away flesh quickly and cleanly. And it's got sharp, strong claws. I literally saw one. I was in the backcountry of Komodo with an Indonesian parks ranger, and we spooked a Komodo dragon, and it skittered away from us in the brush and then went climbing straight up the vertical face of a lava cliff. It was, as I say in the book, it was like watching an alligator climb the side of a four-story building. And it could do that because of these strong claws that it has.
Could this dragon have been interested in dining on you?
It certainly could have. This backcountry ranger and I actually ran into two of them. We were scouting through the terrain there in this one valley of Komodo, looking at Komodo scat, looking at some leftover fragments of bone from old kills. And it's sort of a mixed grassland and forest and scrub habitat with these tall cliffs. And we jumped off a rock and started moving in one direction. And we spooked this one, saw it run away from us and climb up this cliff. And as we were gaping at it, there was another Komodo that came exploding out of the brush just behind us, and I say that they're lurk and lurch predators. They kill their prey by making short-distance attacks, surprising their prey animals at short range. So this Komodo jumped out of the brush and certainly surprised us from behind. We whirled around, and noticed this thing, but noticed that it wasn't coming at us. It was peeling a turn and heading off downhill. It had decided, for whatever reason, that we didn't smell like we would taste good, or it wasn't hungry, or something made it decide not to attack us, but to just escape. So we went chasing after it at just the right speed to make sure that we couldn't catch up with it.
Yeah, well, I don't blame you. What did you see it do?
We chased it for about 100 yards, and it disappeared down into a gully, back into the forested area of this particular valley, and we let it go at that point.
I've had a lot of dreams, I think, where animals like this appear, lizards like this appear.
So have I. Usually they're giant spiders for me, the size of Volkswagens.
Well, didn't you encounter a couple of giant spiders?
My arachnophobia was tested on Guam. The story of Guam is a whole different tale of ecological peculiarities and disruptions. But one of the symptoms of the disruption there now is that there seems to be a population explosion of spiders. So as you go through the understory of the forests on Guam, you run into these huge communal spider webs, like crystal chandeliers hanging in the spaces between trees and shrubs, and you need to duck under those as you're hiking through the forest, and they'll have these large spiders or building spiders, a little bit like the golden garden spider, I believe, that you'd see in the Midwest. There was one particular species that would grow to about the size of the body would be the size of a prune and legs expanding about to the size of a saucer, that particularly captured my attention.
How close did you get to it?
Well, eventually I made a misstep and smudged my face into one of these big communal webs. So I guess that was as close as I got. I didn't quite wrap my face into this particular large female hanging there, but I got close enough that I had to back up and make some very earnest apologies to her.
So the spider was in the web when you ran into the web?
She was in the web, yeah.
Is the web really thick? I mean, spider webs from backyard type spiders are very like flimsy little things. What was the consistency of the web like?
Well, it was fairly stout, fairly strong, but it was a three-dimensional type of web. So it's not the sort that's a two-dimensional plane with a perfect orb. This is a three-dimensional matrix. So when you come charging in and smash your face into it, you're going through dozens and dozens of layers of spider silk.
So did you find a solution to the mystery of why there were so many spiders in Guam?
Well, I didn't find the solution, but I was there to learn about it from the scientists who'd been studying it. What took me to Guam originally was a rash of extinctions of bird populations, endemic birds on the island of Guam, things like the bridled white-eye and the rufous fantail, had suddenly begun going extinct on the island of Guam. Oh, they noticed in the mid-1960s into the 70s that these birds were starting to become rare. And then by the mid-1980s, the populations had disappeared entirely. Nobody could figure out why at first. They thought maybe it was DDT poisoning or some sort of an exotic disease, a viral disease that had come in and killed off the bird populations. And then a graduate student named Julie Savage working there finally discovered that the cause was a species of snake an exotic snake from New Guinea and the Solomon Islands that had invaded the island of Guam, probably having hitchhiked on air transport flights coming back from New Guinea at the end of World War II, had established a population on Guam, had multiplied wildly, and was living at huge population densities in the Guam forest, eating up all of the native Guam birds. This is a tree-climbing, bird-eating species of snake, and there had been no such snake on the island of Guam for previous millennia. So the birds were, ecologically naive. They had no adaptations to defend themselves against this kind of a predator, and consequently it just really raised havoc and eliminated entire populations, entire species of birds.
Now, what's the connection between the snakes, the disappearance of the birds, and the proliferation of spiders?
Well, this part hasn't been proven by scientific study, but the scientists I've talked to speculate that the connection is that when the birds were eliminated by the snake, the spider populations began to explode because the birds had been an important limiting factor on the spiders. So you take out the birds, and the spiders, even though these are native species, the spiders, which are not preyed on by the snakes, begin to flourish. Their population explodes. I thought of Guam for the whole time I was studying it as the forest of spiders and snakes. Scientists talk about this phenomenon as trophic cascades. By that phrase, they essentially mean falling ecological dominoes. One species goes extinct, and that extinction disrupts ecological relationships and can result down the line in further extinctions.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Quammen, and he has a new book called The Song of the Dodo, Island Biogeography in an Age of Extinctions. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with science writer David Quammen. His new book is called Song of the Dodo. You know, on the one hand, you could say, who cares if a species goes extinct, unless, of course, that's going to cause giant spiders to proliferate, in which case I'm absolutely against it. but really, I mean, why should we care?
Well, it's true. Some people say there have always been extinctions. Extinction is a natural process. Doesn't it make room for evolution? To that, my answer is, well, it's a matter of scale. There's always been a pilot light that's been burning in your furnace, so why worry when your house is on fire? The important point is that the level of extinction that is happening now within recent centuries caused by human transformations of the landscape is probably as much as 1,000 times the rate of extinctions that have occurred over the long stretches of geological time. Now, over the long stretches of time, evolution has been able to keep up with extinction so that we have continued to have a rich biosphere. We have new species evolving, being born at roughly the same rate that species were going extinct. That's what scientists call the background level of extinction. Now we're exceeding that background level by 1,000, maybe 10,000 times, and so we're precipitating a massive loss of biological diversity. I think that is a deplorable fact. It's something that we really need to pull back from, to avoid, to stop. In terms of why, some people would say, well, it's because if we eliminate all this biological diversity, it'll threaten ourselves, Homo sapiens as a species. We'll collapse the ecosystems on our own head. It'll come down like a house of cards, and we will drive ourselves extinct as a species. That's sort of the utilitarian or the human-centered argument for preserving biological diversity. It's not the argument that I like to make. It's not the argument that I most believe in. I think it's a dangerous argument because there's all too much of a possibility that humans can survive on an impoverished planet. But to me, the reason that we shouldn't eliminate biological diversity is simply because if we do, we'll leave this planet much lonelier and much uglier than it was 200 or 300 years ago. Our grandchildren will see a planet that's much lonelier and uglier and more biologically impoverished than the one that our grandparents saw. That's not a utilitarian argument. It's, I suppose, more of a spiritual and aesthetic argument. Possibly it's not even an argument. It's just a suggestion. It's what I hope is a persuasive idea, but it's the one that I believe in.
So as part of your travels around the world, you stopped in Rio, and where you were mugged.
Right.
You'd been warned about how dangerous the bus station could be, but you were mugged there. And I was wondering what that made you think about humans while you were studying animal life and lizards and insects.
It was curious because I was on the way to the Atlantic coastal forest of Brazil, north of Rio, to get a look at a particular species of monkey called the Muriqui, the largest of the New World primates. It's a particularly peaceable species of primate in that the males wait in line to mate with the females. The females, I suppose the term is polyandrous or promiscuous, if you wanted to sound more judgmental, which I'm not inclined to do. Anyway, the females mate with lots of males, and the males are perfectly happy with that situation. They wait in line for their turn to mate with a given female who's in heat, and she takes them one by one. And they compete with each other not by fighting, not by showing how long their tails are or how long their canine teeth are. They compete essentially by what's called sperm competition, who delivers the most abundant offering of sperm to the female. And therefore, they don't have to compete by fighting or warfare. So it was just a little bit ironic that I was on the way to see this peculiarly Pacific species of Atlantic forest monkey, and on the way there, I succeeded in getting mugged in broad daylight in downtown Rio by three sort of young street thugs, I guess you'd call them.
Were you okay?
I was okay. I was lucky. I gather that it's not all that uncommon to be mugged in Rio. I suspect the Rio Tourist Bureau won't appreciate me saying this, but it was a mostly nonviolent mugging. I fought back a little bit, rather ignominiously. I was carrying three wallets, and I fought back and hollered and squirmed just enough to save two out of the three, and only lost one of them. And I was lucky that they weren't carrying any guns or knives.
And then from there, it was the monkeys.
And then from there, it was finally up to see the monkeys and look over the shoulder of a scientist named Karen Stryer, who's been working there for more than a decade studying this wonderful creature called the Muriqui.
And what did you learn from watching these monkeys?
Well, I learned that here was another case of insularization. The Atlantic coast forest of Brazil has been chopped into pieces. The Muriqui survive only on these little patches of forest that are surrounded by clear-cut hills, coffee plantations, industrial development, population sprawl, and that each of these little islands of forest supports only a few dozen individuals of the species, the Muriqui. And that's a severe problem. They are fragmented on these little patches of landscape. They face the problem of gene pools that are too small. Their inbreeding depression is a problem in some of these places. And they can't travel between the different islands of habitat to interact with each other, to interbreed. It's another textbook case of the fact that what humans are doing is not just eliminating, reducing the amount of wild landscape in the world, but breaking, chopping what remains of wild landscape into island-like pieces. And that creates this special set of problems that are described by the science of island biogeography.
Well, David Quammen, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Terry, it's a pleasure to talk to you.
David Quammen's new book is called Song of the Dodo. Coming up, Everything But the Girl. This is Fresh Air.
Everything But the Girl is an English duo, Tracy Thorne and Ben Watt, who've been making music together for more than a decade. Originally conceived in reaction to the primitivism of punk rock, Everything But the Girl's dreamy, romantic music has long been popular in England and is starting to gain a larger audience here. Their new release is called Walking Wounded. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
I don't want excuses. I don't want your smiles. I don't want to feel like we're apart a thousand miles. And I don't want your attitude. I don't want your things. But I don't want a phone that never rings. I want your love.
I used to hear the languid tone of Tracy Thorne's voice as a kind of artistic torpor, as a studied miscalculation that thinks coldness and ironic distance are cool and alluring. Sorry, most of the time it's just chilly piffle. But last year, Everything But the Girl scored its first American hit with a dance club remix of their song Missing. The remix, done by producer Todd Terry, did a lot to liven up Everything But the Girl's attenuated rhythms, and in making their follow-up album, vocalist Thorne and instrumentalist Ben Watt have kept that pulse alive. Thorne and Watt have said that the album Walking Wounded is very influenced by the latest trend in British dance music, a style called simply drum and bass. Certainly one of the strengths of Walking Wounded is its varied rhythm sections. The surging beats created by Ben Watt's synthesizers take Tracy Thorne's drawling vocals and give them a good yank, pulling them along in a way that gives their music an unprecedented energy. Even on a slow ballad like this one, called Single, Thorne sounds emotionally involved in a new way.
Called you from the hotel phone. I haven't dialed this code before. I'm sleeping later, waking later. I'm eating less and thinking more. And how am I without you? Am I more myself or less myself? I feel younger, louder, and like I don't always connect. Like I don't ever connect.
For music constructed primarily around its rhythms and melodies, Walking Wounded also has its share of clever lyrics. Everything But the Girl has always specialized in songs about broken hearts and woeful loneliness, often put in the most banal terms. But on this album, the hollow melancholy is filled with juicy jokes and taunts about self-pity, about nursing one's inner child beyond a sensible age. There's a new lift in the music of Everything But the Girl that makes their depression exhilarating.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Walking Wounded by Everything But the Girl. Several stations began to broadcast Fresh Air today. We welcome the listeners of KUAR, Little Rock, Arkansas, WFAE, Charlotte, North Carolina, WUOM, Ann Arbor, Michigan, KUAC, Fairbanks, Alaska, WKNA, Senatobia, Mississippi, WKNQ, Memphis, Tennessee, WIUM, Macomb, Illinois, and KRCB, Rohnert Park, California. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. Additional support comes from Verve Records, presenting Now is the Hour, a new CD of romantic jazz moods from Charlie Hayden's Quartet West. Their website address is verveinteractive.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.